Chief Judge and the Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
The court calls United States v. Frye to counsel.
Good morning. And may it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Commander Brian Meiser and I represent the appellant Joshua Frye. Chief Judge Baker, with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
In United States v. Valadez, this court reaffirms a now 120-year-old precedent from Henry Grimley that an individual who does not voluntarily submit to military authority or who lacks the capacity to do so may not validly enlist. 2 years after that case, Congress amended Article 2 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, specifically set subsections B and C, to codify expressly in the legislative history both Grimley and Valadez. In 2006, a Superior Court sitting in Orange County, California, limited appellant's ability to enter into contracts and gave his grandmother and conservator exclusive control of that right. The effect of that limitation, the court's limitation, is in Appellate Exhibit 10 at 4, which is the declaration of the attorney who applied for that conservatorship order. Individual with 30 years of experience in practicing in probate matters before these courts, and he describes how the language that's in that order limitation ultimately extinguishes appellant's right to contract. It's further explained in the California Probate Code. Section 1828.5 says that a petition shall be dismissed.
As you go through this, are you making the argument that the California law controls, or is this a factor that should be considered as to how Article 2 applies?
California law controls, Your Honor. That determination that the appellant lacked the capacity to contract should be given full faith and credit by this court.
And is that your primary argument? You think that's your strongest argument?
That is the strongest argument, Your Honor. But regardless of whether this court decides not to give full faith and credit to the state court's determination as it is required to do by the federal code, this court can look to the facts. The declaration of the letter of Dr. Nicasio, which is in Appellate Exhibit 2, and also the sworn affidavit of the psychiatrist, or excuse me, psychologist, Dr. Julie Shuck, stating that he can't control his actions, can't control his impulsivity.
Well, doesn't the California statute, by its own terms, not necessarily limit his ability to contract in a limited conservatorship situation? Doesn't that render this contract at most voidable rather than void?
It doesn't, Your Honor, because of the language of the California Probate Code. Under the California Probate Code, under Section 1828.5, the court didn't have to impose a conservatorship if it absolutely wasn't necessary. The court did that. We know that from the papers that are at Appellate Exhibit 2. Under that subsection E of that same provision, the court shall define the duties and powers of a conservator, and there's the expectation that the court is to narrowly tailor the conservatorship to provide the maximum ability of independence for an individual, a disabled adult in this case.
Counsel, what do you do about the fact that subsection B doesn't say anything about capacity to contract? It talks about capacity to understand the significance of enlisting and about the change of status.
And as the court attempts to define that language, this court should look to the legislative history of the amended Article 32, specifically the Senate Armed Services Report, that they're attempting to codify United States versus Valadez.
Yes, and well, what they're trying to do is to make sure that people that have the capacity to understand the significance of enlisting and that take a voluntary oath of office fall under 2B. That's what the legislative history says.
The language, Your Honor, of Valadez was lack of capacity to contract.
But that's not what the statute says. You'll agree with that. And that's not what Henry Grimley was focused on. He was focused on a change of status.
Grimley was focused on a change of status, Your Honor, and it lists a wide range of disabilities, idiocy, infancy, insanity was also listed in there, and then any other thing that renders an individual incapable of changing his status. So Brindley's...
Isn't that to be defined by federal law, by general principles of contract law? Don't you have circuit court opinions holding that enlistment contracts are to be construed by general principles of law? Don't you have how you answer Standard Oil, in which the Supreme Court said that of all relations existing between citizens and the United States, the relationship of the United States to the members of the armed forces is one that has to be governed by federal law. We could look to the California Code for instruction, but are we bound by it in the face of Supreme Court jurisprudence?
Your Honor, 28 U.S.C. 1738 binds
this court. Which was in effect at the time, which dates to 1790 and was in effect when Grimsley was decided, and was in effect when Standard Oil was decided, and was in effect when all these circuit court cases were decided.
That opinion then is, if you will, the California court's determination that the appellant lacked the ability to contract is then plugged into Article 2. So this court must give full faith.
I don't think that they held he lacked the ability to contract. I think that they did something different, which is that they granted his conservator's request that she be given his rights to contract, which is a very different determination.
Well, Your Honor, there's twin determinations there. They limit his right to contract using that term of art under the California Probate Code, and then they give the grandmother exclusive control of the right to contract. So those two things must be read in context. And they also have to be read in context of the petition, which is laid out. Appellate Exhibit 2 is approximately 100 pages of documents. The petition at Joint Appendix 125 says he cannot control his impulsivity. Joint Appendix 128, Joshua is quote, impulsive and lacks the ability to comprehend the terms of a contract.
I don't think that anyone here questions the fact that the individual in question here had problems and was not an ideal candidate for the armed services, okay? But the very different question we have now is whether, by virtue of that fact, he should be able to avoid legal responsibility for the crimes that he committed while he was on active duty. Those are very different questions.
And Your Honor, dating back to Grimley, the Supreme Court in Grimley said that a contract under these circumstances involving idiocy, another disability involving insanity, is void ab initio.
But no one's saying he's insane. That determination, it was a determination of insanity or inability to be tried by reason of insanity has never been made.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think the government
he was developmentally disabled under California law, right? And the whole purpose of that law was to allow people that were not insane but were disabled to live under conditions and with assistance to the best of their abilities.
And the appellant doesn't have the ability to enter into contracts, Your Honor. His grandmother petitioned the court for the ability to protect him essentially from himself.
Is it your contention, counsel, that the 50 states in this country could all basically limit their citizens' rights to be able to join the armed services and that we would be bound by that or instructed by that? I mean, that doesn't seem to make much sense.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the reason here is I don't want the court to lose sight of the fact that this isn't something that's easy to obtain. I mean, there was an adversarial process here. The appellant was appointed a public defender. The court used a probate investigator. There were psychiatrists that testified, and a court ultimately entered into an order. Attorney Gold described some of that process.
And that's fine, but the principle that you're pointing us to is full faith and credit that this determination was made and that we should be bound by it. And so I'm simply asking you, if a state like Massachusetts, for example, decided that it was not appropriate for any person in Massachusetts to be able to enter the armed forces and passed a law to that effect, would we be bound by that? Would that control federal law with respect to the military?
There's no precedent that a state could adopt that wide of a prohibition on service in the military. But Grimley is from 1890, Your Honor, and it lists that narrow class of disabilities, infancy, insanity, idiocy, which would be a 19th century term for mental retardation or some other developmental disability.
Well, I mean, you're reaching there, though, counsel.
Statute.
They are, absolutely,
yeah,
Your
that's
Honor.
That's 504. Absolutely. That's what's now 504.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, they're not talking state law there. They're talking what's in the federal statute. Well, you're talking right. Something that's controlled by Congress.
I think the real two points here is the courts look, federal courts look to state court determinations all the time. If this were a prosecution for, say, adultery, and the defense wanted to introduce a state court determination of a divorce, I hardly doubt that the government would be standing here saying that we, as a federal question, have to determine whether the marriage was dissolved. It's also the issue of felonies. Felony is another bar to enlistment. If an individual was convicted in a state, the government wouldn't sit here and say, look, we have to determine whether this is a felony for purposes of federal law. We would simply apply the state court determination and then apply that to Article 2. That's all that's at issue in this case.
Can we put the preemption aside for a moment and
yes,
talk about the text of B and C?
Yes, Your Honor.
With respect to C, how do you deal with the notwithstanding any other provision of law clause?
Well, the legislative history of
traditionally, when a executive branch lawyer sees notwithstanding any other provision of law, they say it means notwithstanding any other provision of law. They can do whatever they want using that authority.
Indeed, Your Honor. Guided by the legislative history, which says that C is intended to codify the doctrine of constructive enlistment, again from Gremley. But the appellant would lack two elements there. Number one being voluntariness.
So just to be clear, your view on notwithstanding any other provision of law is that C would be applicable if it applied.
That's correct.
And now you're going to tell me why 1, 2, 3, and 4 don't apply, I assume.
Yes, Your Honor. And so the definition of insanity, as defined in 1 U.S.C. Section 1, non compos mentis, and that's what's at issue. I mean, it has never been you will not find a case to suggest that insanity is as narrow as the government promotes.
Can I ask then, are you arguing that one submitted voluntarily to military authority does not apply because your client was insane?
He has a
someone who lacks the capacity to understand the significance of enlisting cannot do so voluntarily? Or are you arguing that someone who has the attributes of your client cannot voluntarily do so?
Your Honor, he, according to the medical evidence that is in the record, has impulse control disorders, and so we would suggest that he cannot, as a matter of fact, voluntarily submit to military authority.
How do you define voluntary in this context?
Your Honor,
equivalent to capacity, or is it something else?
It's an entirely different legal standard, and I think the court could be instructed by the insanity defense as it existed before 1984, where voluntariness was actually a component of the insanity defense.
And so, how are you defining it, or how do you wish that we define it?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that it's necessary to define it because you have medical records in Appellate Exhibit 2 suggesting that he has an impulse control disorder. He can't control. He gets fixated. The letter of Dr. Nicasio says he gets fixated on cigarettes and will steal, lie, cheat, and do everything he can do to satisfy that impulse. And then also we have the issue of capacity. He simply doesn't have the capacity to understand the terms of a contract. And that's in the petition.
And therefore cannot voluntarily do this.
Yes, Your Honor. It's bolstered by that secondary finding.
What exactly is our standard of review? Are we reviewing this de novo?
Your Honor, there's several layers to it. The government has the burden of proving jurisdiction by a preponderance of the evidence. That's from the Taylor case out of the 2002 term of this court.
Well, see, the judge ruled that they did.
Excuse me, the Oliver case.
Yeah, the judge ruled they met that burden. So are we reviewing his ruling as a matter of law or as a matter of fact?
It's de novo review of the government's burden. So the judge's findings of fact are reviewed for clear error, and the legal conclusions are then reviewed for or reviewed de novo, Your Honor.
So the clean ruling in this case, to go back to Judge Baker's earlier questions, would be the error was not giving full faith and credit to the probate court order.
That's the cleanest way to do it, Your Honor. Federal courts in this country give full faith and credit to state court determinations all the time. There's nothing exotic about this whatsoever.
But that doesn't take you out of C. I mean, that takes you out of B, right? You can use the state court's conservatorship agreement to say, well, because of that, this wasn't a valid enlistment, right? So that takes it out of B. But that doesn't impact C.
Well, I think that determination impacts the voluntariness component of C, Your Honor, and I think it also impacts the...
But voluntariness for purposes of C can't be the same, exact thing as voluntary purposes for, voluntariness for purposes of B, or it would be a redundant portion of the statute.
And I think that between those two provisions of Article 2, UCMJ, and Section 504 and 505, you have a very circular loop to codify both Grimley and Valadez. That's in the legislative history, Your Honor. They're trying to cover all their bases. What Congress was chiefly concerned with was the Russo case out of this court, dealing with recruiter misconduct.
Well, and they were concerned, and I'm reading from the Senate report that they strongly believe that that those doctrines, the ones that you're talking about, serve no useful purpose, et cetera, no military member who voluntarily enters a service and serves routinely for a time should be allowed to raise for the first time after committing an offense, defects in his or her enlistment, totally escaping punishment for offenses as a result.
Indeed,
and they talk about that because of the of how it undermines military good order and discipline.
Indeed, and that dates back...
And the military justice system.
And that dates back to Grimley, Your Honor, where a 40-year-old man enlisted saying that he was a 28-year-old. And the Supreme Court said that that deception is not going to relieve him of the contract. And the only contracts that will be void are those involving idiocy, infancy, any other disability which would prevent an individual from changing his or her status. And that's precisely
but
what this...
So what we need to then conclude is that those categories apply to your client.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Could I ask you to, if you're done with it?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe so.
Could I ask you to please indicate, using the military judge's findings and conclusions, which findings, if any, are clearly erroneous, and which conclusions misapprehend the law?
I think one of the findings, Your Honor, that is lost is on page 205, where the military judge concludes that Gunnery Sergeant Thiessen had also been advised by the accused that Mary Beth Frye had a conservatorship over him. Thiessen was also aware that Mary Beth Frye did not want the accused to join the Marine Corps. And so this whole constructive enlistment argument that the government raises, that somehow Mary Beth Frye acquiesced, is simply not borne out in the military judge's findings of fact. She objected from day one. Within 3 weeks of him being at boot camp, she had a conversation on February 7th of 2008. She had a conversation with HM1 Lawler. She said that she wanted her grandson brought home. And actually, HM1 Lawler, if you look at the next page of the joint appendix, Your Honor, on pages 206 and 207, HM1 Lawler told Mary Beth Frye that they would send her grandson home. She then had a conversation with Gunnery Sergeant Thiessen and demanded again that he be brought home. And so I think that the military judge gets much of the facts right in this case, Your Honor, but just simply misapplies the law.
Can I ask you two specific questions? On page 209, the military judge states, all the evidence indicates that the accused enlistment was voluntary. There is no evidence whatsoever that the enlistment or submission to military authority at any time was involuntary. Is that a conclusion of law or a finding of fact?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I answer your question?
You may.
It's a conclusion of law, Your Honor. Voluntariness and capacity to contract are legal conclusions informed by facts.
Do you believe it is accurate that there is no evidence whatsoever at any time that it was involuntary?
No, Your Honor.
On the no evidence aspect of that?
No, Your Honor. The court has before it, dating back to 2006, a letter from Dr. Nicasio recommending that appellant be institutionalized.
But this depends on us adopting your view of involuntary, which means that because he is developmentally disabled, that nothing he does is voluntary with respect to contracts.
Your Honor, I don't think it's because of his disability. It's because of the specific characteristics of this appellant. He has an impulse control disorder, which may at some point have given rise to the classic definition of the insanity defense as it was defined by the American Law Institute before the Hinckley modifications that occurred in 1984 to that defense.
I have one more question, but I'll ask it on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Kevin Shan. I represent the United States.
this court should affirm the lower court's decision because personal jurisdiction.
Counsel, I'm having trouble hearing you again, just like yesterday. Would you push that up, please? And talk slower.
Sure.
Thank you.
You should affirm the lower court's decision for three reasons, and why, that's why personal jurisdiction exists. Number one, Congress legislates for regulation of the armed forces. That's mandated by the Constitution, and they have done so in Article 2 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Number two, California law, while it is relevant, is not binding on this court or determinative as to whether or not the appellant had capacity to understand the effect of his enlistment in the armed forces, which is the standard for enlistment under Article 2B. And number three, as Article 2C clearly states, notwithstanding any other provision of law, which must necessarily include California Probate Code, you can have a constructive enlistment when the four prongs are met. And in this case, they are.
How do you find voluntarily?
Looking at, I guess, the root of the word, Your Honor, I mean, it's through his own volition. You can have impulse control, however, that wouldn't prevent you from conducting, you know, going to the bathroom, speaking with people, communicating. And in this case, I think
that's not the clearest definition. Can you try just plain English definition?
Whether or not you can stop yourself from doing something as you conduct your daily business, and whether or not it's anyone has actually forced you or compelled you to do something.
Is there a statutory definition of voluntarily that we should be applying here, or is this just a case of a court figuring out what definition it's going to choose to apply?
I think this court would look at perhaps a better definition than I just gave, but if you look at the dictionary definition, Your Honor, as to what voluntary means.
Which means just, there's no particular statutory definition the government is indicating we should adopt.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any statutory definition of voluntary. But I think you would look at the facts in the record, which would be indicia of voluntariness. And in this case, it would be the appellant returning from Colorado and on his own calling the military recruiter and seeking enlistment. He seeks out the recruiter. He then goes, takes the ASVAB. He scores a 56 on the AFQT, a 105 on the GT, which are well above the minimums. In addition, appellant's brief is plainly misleading. He talks about not having the capacity to enlist, and he cites that he has an IQ of 70. Quoting page 318 of the record. He ignores
it. 70 at age 3.5, is that correct?
That's correct. And in his brief, he leaves it there. The truth is, three pages later, that same witness testifies, Ms. Mary Beth Fry, that his IQ is now in the lower 90s.
Can I ask a question about the military judge's findings and conclusions? On page 210, the military judge states, all of the evidence indicates that the accused had, and since the time he took the oath of enlistment, the de facto capacity to contract and the actual capacity to understand the significance of enlisting in the armed forces. Is it the government's view that that is an accurate statement of the record, that all of the evidence indicates that?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. By preponderance of the evidence, to include the defense evidence.
My question was not applying the preponderance of the evidence standard. Is it in fact the case that all of the evidence, including the California Probate Court, the Shuck declaration, the grandmother's testimony or statement, that all indicates that he had the capacity to enlist?
Does everything point towards that? In sum, yes. However, Your Honor, absolutely. If your question is there evidence pointing to the contrary, there is.
So did the military judge get that statement correct or incorrect?
He did. I think internalized there is that it was based on the totality of the evidence that he received in court. I mean, he received evidence from 8 live witnesses at the motions hearing, documented evidence from both sides. And then based on that, he said all evidence points to him having the legal capacity.
Is that statement, all of the evidence indicates that he had the actual capacity to understand the significance of enlisting, is that a conclusion of law or a finding of fact?
I would agree with the appellant's counsel that if he's dealing with whether or not it was voluntary in the aspect of Article 2C, that I believe that would be a conclusion of law.
Does the government agree with the military judge's statement on page 211? That the petition on which the finding was based presents little evidence to distinguish the accused in terms of his capacity to understand the significance of enlistment from a great bulk of 18-year-olds, and by implication, most of the people that were going into the armed forces. Is that the government's view, that the judge has that accurate?
I believe it's accurate, yes, Your Honor. If you look at the evidence on the record, appellant was in fact diagnosed autistic. However, as testified by medical experts, improved over time. He saw his IQ grow and raise. He saw his qualifying scores be well within the minimums for the services. If you look at his unsworn statement in the record, between pages 326 and 327, he's articulate, he's well-spoken, he can communicate quite easily. The state court in this case, I'd like to clear up an issue there as well, as to what actually California state law said. California was by no means a judicial determination of incapacity. The language that appellant quotes in his brief is actually referring to the conservatorship of the estate, which is separate apart and is not involved in this case. What we have here is a limited conservatorship over the person. And the California probate code clearly says that a limited conservatee, such as the appellant, will not be presumed incompetent under the California state code. So there's nothing, and there's no legal conclusion by the California state court that he lacked the capacity. His rights were limited in the California code.
Are you referring to section 1800.3, subsection D?
I'm referring to 1801, Your Honor, where it says that limited conservatees are not presumed incompetent.
Was there a 706 board in this case?
There was, yes, Your Honor.
And what was the conclusion of that board?
Dr. Bruce Reed, Navy psychologist with a wealth of experience, testified that there was no severe mental disorder defect, which prevented him from understanding the quality and nature of his actions and at the time of his offenses, in addition that he could assist in his own defense. One additional question was asked. This is Dr. Reed, had a wealth of experience, was a reservist, who actually dealt with conservatorships in California in his private capacity. And he was asked whether or not his professional medical opinion, by preponderance of the evidence, could the appellant understand the capacity? Did he have the capacity to understand the effect of his enlistment? And Dr. Reed answered yes.
Was the doctor aware of the California conservatorship at that point?
He was, yes, Your Honor. And he was aware of appellant's autism. And I think that's another point in the appellant's brief that is highly misleading. When the doctor testified in court, he had already spoken with Mr. Fry. Fry had informed him that, in fact, he had autism, that it was a conservatorship. Dr. Reed was acutely aware of that.
And he was aware of the scope of the conservatorship?
No, Your Honor. He was not aware as to all the details. He had, by his estimation, 75% good information. The rest of it, the appellant kind of trailed off.
So he wasn't aware of the findings of the court? He was aware there was a conservatorship order, but not exactly what it said.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, Dr. Reed also performed, cognitive testing, spoke with the appellant for a period of time, had, again, a wealth of experience in this area of law, and was able to ascertain from that appellant did have the capacity to understand the effect of his enlistment.
And he did say he was aghast, though, when he learned of this, did he not?
He did. That would speak to, I think, his intent there, his language there indicates, I can't believe he was able to enlist in the military, I can't believe he was enlisted. However, you look back to Grimley, appellant cites to Grimley, I invite this court to look at Grimley. Grimley says you can't use it as a sword once you've enlisted and withheld pertinent facts. You don't get to use it as a sword to void your enlistment.
Didn't he say that under the conservatorship order that Fry wouldn't even have the ability to buy a car?
He said that. He said, I'm not sure he'd be able to buy a car. He also intimates it at...
That certainly indicates that he doesn't have the capacity to contract under the conservatorship order, according to the government's witness.
He said he wasn't sure, and that would again pertain to California state law.
Would you agree, given that fact, would you agree that resolving the case under 2C is an easier argument for the government to make than adhering to 2B?
I would agree, Your Honor, that it's easier to the extent this court finds California law not just relevant but binding. So if you find it binding, Article 2B would be harder for us. Article 2C certainly is the easier avenue in that respect. However, I believe this court can find jurisdiction under Article 2B or Article 2C of the Uniform Code. But yes, in a shorter answer, and I apologize, 2C is easier.
Okay, would you address the full faith and credit statute and the appellant's position on that?
Yes, Your Honor. The two hypotheticals that appellant gave dealing with giving full faith and credit to the marriage, he's absolutely right. We wouldn't come in here and say you couldn't do that. If you look at Allen, this court held that you had to give full faith and credit there because there was no prevailing federal interest. He also gave a second hypo of a felony. Felony is defined in the USC. So giving full faith and credit here, when this court held in Allen that the military court has to give preclusive effect and full faith and credit to a state court's determination, you do so unless there is a prevailing federal interest. And that prevailing federal interest is Congress, as mandated by the U.S. Constitution, regulating for the armed forces. That's why you have Article 2 of the Uniform Code. That's why you have 10 U.S.C. 504 and 10 U.S.C. 505. So his hypotheticals fall apart upon themselves, and full faith and credit is not, is nowhere to be invoked in this specific case.
Well, is what you're saying that the federal statute, that the constitutional power of Congress to make rules for the governance of land naval forces, as expressed in those statutes, indicates congressional intent to preclude the application of state law?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that would come from Solario of the United States.
Do you have any case law support for that?
I do, yes, Your Honor. In Solario, the Supreme Court said the constitutional grant of the power to Congress to regulate the armed forces appears in the same section as does regulating commerce, coining money, and declaring war. And they reference Article 1, Section 8, Clause 14 of the United States Constitution, which gives Congress the authority and the mandate to regulate the land and naval forces. By no means is a state court determination binding on this court. And the idea that 50 states would be able to legislate and determine the state of contract law for enlistments in the military is unsupported by anything but a restatement which does not address the unique nature of the military.
Well, as I would understand your argument, we can give full faith and credit to the California order and still rule in favor of the government.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
So we don't have to involve thumbing our nose at California to rule in favor of the government.
Yes, Your Honor. I know from the government's perspective, we wouldn't view it as thumbing your nose. It would be invoking that language this court used in Allen for the prevailing federal interest. But yes, absolutely.
Back to Judge Ryan's question, as I understood it, let's say the state of South Carolina decided we didn't want anybody under 21 to have the right to contract, just prohibit the right to contract. And an 18-year-old joined the Marine Corps. We wouldn't give full faith and credit to South Carolina under those.
No, Your Honor, of course not, because the military is governed by, it's a creature of Congress and federal statute. So no, state law in that case would have no binding precedent and wouldn't be binding upon this court. So yes, we could certainly win, and we should win on Article 2C. The argument would be that we have a strong argument that he did have the capacity to understand the significance of enlisting the armed forces for purposes of jurisdiction under Article 2B. The indicia of the capacity to understand the effect of enlisting is throughout the record. As we discussed, the military judge heard from 8 live witnesses, received testimony, and the pertinent facts...
Did the military judge have the Schuck Declaration before him at the time?
Yes, Your Honor, he did.
Does the military judge cite the Schuck Declaration in his findings and conclusions of law?
I don't think he cites to her by name, Your Honor. I think he talks about that the extent of appellant's diagnoses, that he was diagnosed at a young age. I don't believe he talks about Dr. Schuck's declaration by name.
Do you believe that the military judge adequately addresses the Schuck Declaration, and in particular, the statement that as a result of his conditions, he is preoccupied with his immediate needs at the risk of his long-term benefits? His brain does not utilize critical thought and reasoning as demonstrated by his impulsive behavior. Due to his autism and ADHD, he fails to weigh the consequences of his actions. Where in the military judge's findings and conclusions is that particular conclusion from the treating psychologist addressed?
That particular conclusion is not specifically addressed.
Is in the government's view, is that an important judgment by the treating psychologist?
It's important and it's relevant. The military judge heard all the evidence and made his decision.
I think it's not addressed by the military judge.
No, Your Honor, but it's important. No, Dr. Schuck actually testified before the military judge. The live testimony comes around the record at page 310. And if you look at that record, Dr. Schuck backs off some of those declarations a great deal. She no longer says when she's under oath that he lacks the capacity to contract. Her stance softens. She talks about how he went from low functioning to high functioning. She says that when she first got him and started treating him, that he wasn't up to where he eventually would be. She talks about how he was vastly improved. Now, to be fair, she also says, doesn't change my recommendation, but her statement, her live testimony, is really, I believe, a lot softer than the harsher language she used when she's not under oath.
Can someone who is insane voluntarily submit to military authority?
No, Your Honor.
Can someone who does not understand the capacity of enlisting voluntarily submit to military authority?
Can they enlist?
Can they voluntarily submit to military authority if they don't understand the significance of what they're doing?
I think that you're talking about a state court order and preclusive effect, just blankly, if they can't...
No, I'm asking you an abstraction that obviously has something to do with this case, but those are the only facts you're being provided. Treat it as a hypothetical rather than a concession.
If they lack the capacity to understand the effect of enlisting, could they do so voluntarily?
Correct.
I don't believe so. Now, as a matter of...
I understand that's not your position here. I'm asking you a legal question, not a fact-based, case-specific question.
Yeah, yes, Your
Honor. It's not a trap, it's just a question.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand. I just think in that limited context that you provided, it'd be hard to say it would be a voluntary enlisting if you didn't have the capacity. However, luckily it's not in a vacuum. We have a developed record.
Right,
and
I'm circling back to the original questions. How do you define voluntarily?
Sir. Whether or not someone can act without being forced to do so, whether or not an action is undertaken on their own.
But you would agree as an abstraction that if you lack the capacity to understand what you're doing in enlisting, you cannot voluntarily enlist?
I would agree. Now, Your Honor, if I may just clarify that point. If we're talking about a legal conclusion of termination by a state court, that would, we would agree, potentially, if this court finds it binding, would affect Article 2B purposes. But that would be a decision of law. I don't think that would be binding for Article 2C purposes. So that conclusion, if you're giving full faith and credit, you can give full faith and credit to say at the time he enlisted, he didn't have the capacity based on California state law, which we think is would be an incorrect conclusion.
For purposes of 2C, what weight, if any, should we give to the conclusions of the 706 board?
You should give a great deal of weight, Your Honor. Dr. Reed met with the appellant, spoke with him, and he concluded that at the time he enlisted, he did not have he did not have an impairment which prevented him from understanding the effect of his actions. And that's important because one of the charges in this case is a fraudulent enlistment, which means Dr. Reed determined that at the time he enlisted, he didn't have a severe mental disease or defect which prevented him from knowing, essentially, the wrong or right in his action. So it definitely should weigh on this court in making its determination should this court go down the line of Article 2C in a constructive enlistment.
Counsel, if you were sitting around the legal office and the Marine recruiter stopped by your office and said, "Sir, I've got a guy that wants to join the Marine Corps, and he brought me this California order that says he has a doesn't have a capacity to contract. Can I join? Can I let him join?" What would you answer me?
As an attorney, Your Honor, I would say, one, you've got to dig into that conservatorship, find out when it was ordered, find out if it actually says he has the capacity to contract. The government disputes the appellant's characterization of that document. But the ultimate advice most likely is going to be, as an attorney, we've got other people out there to enlist. It's not worth the difficulty, and we want to stay on the right course. But I think it's important to note that under that hypothetical, that draws away from appellant's actions in this case, where he says, "I have a conservatorship." What he doesn't tell anybody is, "I've got autism, I've got asthma, I've had an appendectomy." He doesn't tell anybody that when he lies on his MEPS forms, when he's enlisting, he doesn't say that he had the extent of his psychological treatment. He doesn't talk about his child porn addiction treatment. He doesn't talk about treatment of care and doctors. All those facts which he withholds.
Well, back quickly to Chief Judge Baker's question, and looking at the question of capacity and voluntariness, assuming that he did not have the capacity without the consent of his grandmother couldn't provide that capacity, could she? As far as the voluntariness goes. Either he's capable of making a decision to join the Marine Corps and eating their food and taking their pay and all those things, but his grandmother can't supply that capability under the federal law, can she?
Well, if you're relying on the state law to inform federal law for his capacity, I think you should look at the language of the California Probate Code first. We don't agree that it stripped his right to contract. At most, it would make it voidable. And now, I know the appellant said in his first turn that there's nothing to indicate that, and that's not true. The reality is Ms. Fry shows up at the graduation for boot camp. Ms. Fry, with full knowledge of her role as a conservator in California, calls nobody, seeks no sort of federal injunction from appellant attending and continuing boot camp. After boot camp, appellant goes home on boot leave, he comes back. At no point does she step in to stop him. So Ms. Fry, in our opinion, at most, would have the opportunity to seek to make this contract voided. And she did not do so. Your Honor, I see that I'm almost out of time. In conclusion.
The appellant has some bonus time. You're welcome to have bonus time if you want it, but you're also welcome to conclude.
Your Honor, briefly. Article 2B, Congress lays out a valid enlistment. The facts and the record in here play out such that appellant did have the capacity to understand the effect of his enlistment, and it was done so voluntarily. Should this court find the California Probate Code was determinative and not just relevant but somehow binding, it doesn't preclude finding a constructive enlistment. Appellant met all four prongs. It was, in fact, voluntary. His impulsive nature did not prevent him from seeking the recruiter out, going through the recruiter, signing enlistment documents, lying where he had to, and enlisting. He received military pay, he performed military duties, and he was not insane, which is the only pertinent language from 10 U.S.C. 504 that could even apply in this case. He was not insane within the meaning of that term, and a constructive enlistment can be found for personal jurisdiction in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Is there a rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
With respect to the constructive enlistment doctrine and Section 2C, this court must look or rely heavily on the declaration of Julie Schock, which counsel has indicated wasn't under oath. It was actually sworn under penalty of perjury. On page 199, Dr. Schock says that appellant has the mind of a 14-year-old, and that's laid out. That is exactly the issue that is, or excuse me, exactly the age of the individual at issue in United States versus Blanton, a constructive enlistment case where this court found that constructive enlistment was inapplicable to someone who could never statutorily serve in the armed forces. And that's exactly what we have here. We have an individual who is incapacitated and incapable of ever meeting the statutory definition under 504 of serving in the armed forces.
And the government argued that the Schock declaration and their testimony she walked back, is that your view?
I don't agree with that whatsoever, Your Honor. She further explained some of the testimony. She talks about how an individual can improve. She also talks about on page 312 how an individual can regress with a condition that appellant has. And so you have a clear statement in the declaration and also in the testimony. I invite the court to compare the two, and you will find her not backing off of the statement. Never does she say, well, I said he has the mind of a 14-year-old. Well, actually, he has the mind of an adult. This is an individual who has the mind of a 14-year-old child. This court should treat him as such. Really, what is at issue with, in this case is how can a parent who has a developmentally disabled adult care for that child? He or she can go to to a probate court in his or her state. He or she cannot go to a court-martial because those are not sitting courts as this court understands it. There's no federal probate court. The only thing that they can do is exactly what Ms. Fry did in this case. She went to a probate court. She eventually took the appellant, using her capacity to determine his residence, to a group home for the mentally disabled.
Counsel, the problem is you want to make this case about the developmentally disabled child, and really what the case is about is whether the military courts have jurisdiction to try him for the offenses that he committed while on active duty, which is, in my mind at least, a very different question.
Well, Your Honor, what she did to protect him from himself, and that's the language that the attorney who applied for the conservatorship uses in Appellate Exhibit 10, is to apply for conservatorship because he was doing things that were destructive to himself. She had the California court limit, according to the California Probate Code, his ability to enter into a contract. As Dr. Reed testified, an individual who didn't have appellant's entire medical record, this individual couldn't buy a car, he couldn't file suit.
Do you have a case that would make what the problems that he suffered from constitute insanity for purposes of 10 U.S.C. 504?
Your Honor, there are several cases cited. Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, if I may answer the question. There are several cases cited in the reply brief dealing with non-compos mentis in that definition, which is also codified in 1 U.S.C. and referenced by the lower court's decision. If Your Honor would give me a moment, I can cite those cases, but they are actually in the reply brief, Your Honor.
Anything else, counsel?
No, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you. The court thanks counsel for their arguments, and before we stand in recess, I'll just note that we're going to adjourn the court. You all get to stand up and sit down again, and then we're going to do a Q&A session and entertain any questions you may have out there, as long as they're not about the case, either directly or indirectly or likely. Okay, may you please adjourn the court?